tonight, Bud, who's well known by many of us in the room, is going to speak. And his sobriety year was 1989. And I see him most often at the 545 meetings, and everybody that hears him there is looking forward to it, I'm sure. And those that haven't heard him, he is sure to open your mind to the good things at AA. Thank you. I'm an alcoholic. My name is Bud. It used to be Buddy. I'm really Buddy Mayfield, and it's what it was for many years until I decided I had the need to be more sophisticated, so I use Bud. And that's about as anonymous as I can get. I'll start at the beginning. I won't issue all the disclaimers that I've rehearsed to come up here to issue to you, but there'll be implied disclaimers throughout my talk. I've tried several times to outline my talk, and it never works out. I understand, you know, the talk you plan to give, the talk you give, and then the talk you should have given. I hope I fall somewhere in between this. I'll start at the beginning. I was born February 19, 1937, right in Atlanta, Georgia. That makes me a certified member of the OF Society, and I'm sure you can figure that out. My sobriety date was stated as June 3rd, 1989. I was born, as I say, here in Atlanta to parents just prior to World War II. My father abandoned us at that time. He was in the Marine Corps, and subsequently left shortly thereafter to go into combat. So I was raised pretty much by my mother and my grandmother and great-grandmother. I didn't see much of my mother. She was only 18 when I was born. And I don't know whether that left a lasting impression on me or not, or whether it affected me or not. But my entire life, I was not on the timid side, I was on the frightened side. I was scared of the dark, I was scared of all kinds of things. I still have trouble with some of that today. I've been able to overcome a lot of it, and I'm still overcoming a lot of it. But I had a World War II beginning upbringing. My mother remarried, and my stepfather, who adopted me, his name was Mayfield. And we traveled all around during World War II. He was in the service, never overseas, but it was a wartime atmosphere. And there was never a central place to be. We were on the move, or living in trailers, or being moved here and there, and then following, bagging up the car and going. And here again, I don't know what effect this had on me, and how it relates to my alcoholism, but I'm sure it had some effect on me. There was never any much stability. I got involved in, and this is part of my story, it's not for self-aggrandizement, I got involved in sports. Keep in mind, this was 1937, 38, 39. I got a little older, into the 40s. I got that. All I wanted to do was play sports. Didn't matter what it was. Back then, you could play in the streets, and we did. All the activity, because people went home at night. Commerce was finished, and you were home having dinner at 6:30 at night at the latest. So you played in the street. I went on. Moved around a couple of times. My parents bought a house and moved. Went to high school, right up here at Bass High School in Atlanta. And that's where, keeping in mind, when I say I got involved in sports, I had the physique somewhat closely related to a Q-tip. I had kind of blonde hair, and when I wore white shoes, you mistook me for one. So needless to say, I was not known as Thunder Thighs. I was not known as the terror of the football field or the basketball or baseball or whatever it was. But as as I got on into high school, and there was, my parents may have drunk, I don't know. Like I say, my mother remarried. My family didn't drink at that time. And I was not around any drinking at all. But coming up into high school and the athletic, through athletics, that's where I started developing an identity. I was too scared and too frightened and too shy in other areas. But I felt that without knowing, being able to verbally identify it, that became my avenue to being accepted in my school. And I combined that with an attitude of let's be nice. And if I can be nice and endear myself or ingratiate myself to you in some way, I'm going to be all right. And that pervaded, and it still does to some degree to today. But I was able to develop scholastically primarily because schoolwork came right easy for me. I never learned. I never developed like some people in here I know and have a great deal of respect for. I never developed a real big work ethic except through sports. But here again, you know, that was fun. That was identity. That gave me acceptance. It gave me an identity. It's kind of fragile, but it was an identity. I was always worried about people liking me. It was something I just really wanted. And I got real upset when people didn't like me. I developed an aggressiveness and a defiance through this attitude or this underlying layer of fear or layers of fear, whichever one it was. And that expanded as I got older. I was good enough in athletics to get a college scholarship to play. I ended up playing two varsity sports, and I was glad, and I excelled in. I was a pretty good athlete, and I excelled in both of them to some degree. I developed a terrifying fear of being hurt, so I ran real fast. I was able to evade and avoid most of that. And I won some things in on a small scale in track and field. And that continued on through college. Now, in college, I started drinking beer. However, all through high school, I didn't drink it. I was one of the goody boys, the good boys. But I was accepted with my peer group because of the athletics. And I developed some good friendships, and still some friendships I still have to this day that developed when I was in the 6th and 7th grade, 5th and 6th grade, whatever it was, that I talked to them, talked to one the other day. And we've known each other all our lives. And that's, I cherish and value that. Where am I? Anyway, the athletic thing, identity, developed a lot more so in college because I developed some pretty good skills in there. I did passable, but barely passable schoolwork. As I say, I had my first beer. I think I drank a few swallows of beer off and on during my real young periods of life. But I didn't really like the taste of it. Until I knew that at one time I was going to have to develop a taste for beer, because in order to belong and to be with in the fraternities and in the other activities, I was going to have to drink beer. Well, when I started, I took off running good. And the first time I had a senior girl invite me to a dance one night. And boy, I was a hot shot. I was a big shot. This was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, just absolutely gorgeous senior girl, and I had arrived. I was a dumb hick freshman that was feeling my oats a little bit. And that night, it was in Columbia, South Carolina, that night, the cops picked me up and a couple others. I was rolling a garbage can down Main Street in Columbia, South Carolina. I think we were in a race of some sort, but I don't know what. And they were going to take us to jail until, truly, and this is the way it was, and back then it was that way, this way. They found out, you know, that I was in the athletic department, or involved in athletics. They took me back to the dorm. I never saw that blonde girl again. I couldn't figure out why. In fact, when I did see her, she went the other way. And that's the truth. I didn't drink often. As I say, I was involved in two varsity sports. I couldn't drink that often. Number one, I didn't have the money. That was the primary reason. I didn't really have the funds to do it on a $15 laundry check every month, and that's about all, because my family didn't. They weren't particularly well off. They were lower middle income family. They did all right. We lived all right, and I never wanted anything. We just didn't have an abundance of money. Anyway, just about every time I drank thereafter, I got drunk. I would end up doing just really dumb things. But they were things that gave me recognition and identity. And I thought that was what endeared or ingratiated myself to these people. It was like putting on a pair of cellophane breeches and showing your ass to the world. And I did that. I learned how to do that quite often. And I used to carry that cellophane suit with me just in a lot of places, and later on in life I carried it too. But got out of school. I was drafted to play in the NFL by a man named Lombardi, and that's my claim to fame. I thought I was going to be the world's gift to the NFL. I had made all neighborhood one year, and I knew that was going to take me to the heights of the NFL. that didn't last long. It lasted parts of 2 years. Now, in the interim time, I had met and through athletics and through just knowing some people and this and that and the other, I married just she was a truly, and still is, a truly pretty woman. She was not beautiful, glamorous, or anything like that. She was just pretty. Blonde, blue-eyed, dimples that went to, you know, the other side of her cheeks. And we had two children. And I had married way above myself socioeconomically, way above. Through the contacts and the associations and the people I was invited to participate with, we met, and it was she's a truly wonderful girl. And as I say, we had two children. I screwed that up and did that royally. I thought everyone drank the way I did. I was not an everyday drinker and every night drinker at that time. This was in my 20s, late to middle 20s, give or take 2 or 3 years. And I had gotten a real good job and screwed that up too, because I didn't perform the duties of the job real well. I thought all I had to do was just go around being Buddy Mayfield and meeting and greeting people. And even though I'd had, like I say, I had terrific contacts, but I didn't fulfill the requirements of the job. I wanted to have a good time. I wanted to be a big shot. And in some way, in large measure, I thought I was. But I was living in the past. Many, many people had the same or similar opportunities to me, and they didn't suffer the consequences I did. And I couldn't really figure it out. Why, you know, why is this happening to me? Why is this not happening to me? Don't they know how how whatever I am, how good I am, how smart I am, how whatever. And I can do this, and I could do it, because I did do it, but I didn't do it consistently and persistently. I was too focused on making an impression. And I already had everything I needed, everything I'd really ever wanted. I had a house, a stable, didn't have a house at that time, had an apartment. Like I say, a really pretty wife and two great children who have ultimately and subsequently succeeded very well in life, very stable, and I'm glad of that. I now have a relationship with them. But essentially what I did later on was, you've heard the phrase, and I'm sure you've heard it applied the way I'm about to apply it. I was looking for love in all the wrong places. I had the love. I just kept looking for the identity. I kept looking for kept trying to be a big shot instead of focusing on what I was doing and fulfilling the responsibilities and the opportunities that I had. Sid, you know, Sid, she gave a talk when I first got sober. I was about 2 or 3 years sober, I guess. And she was talking about the lost opportunities in her life. And I related to it immediately because I had thrown away, neglected, discharged so many opportunities that were just laid there, just laid out for me. And somehow or another, I screwed them up. The only constant in my life was me. And people tried to counsel me on it. People tried to work with me on it. And I wouldn't hear it. I was too big a big shot. The phrase, you can tell an alcoholic, but you can't tell him much, applied to me in uppercase letters. I wasn't going to listen. I subsequently, and this is, I won't elaborate on this, but this just says a lot about how I was. I subsequently abandoned, for the most part, responsibility for my wife and children. I did not support my wife and children like I should have and like I could have. I was engaged in trying to be a big shot. I don't like telling that, but that's in a general way, but it's pretty specific. And you gather what you will from that. But that's the way it was. I didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a couple of friends. I had one friend, a man that brought me down here. He's got 34, 35 years now. And I've got a little, I'm almost 20, not quite. But I told him I didn't need it. It was right downstairs in Napa. And everybody I saw down there when we went downstairs, there was a pall of smoke about head high. And if you stood up, you could see the people, and if you sat down, you couldn't see the people, or vice versa. And everybody looks like I do now, old and fat and gray. And I said, I don't know. I was 35 years old, and I didn't need that stuff. You know, I can do this. I'll quit drinking, but I'll do it later. Later and tomorrow were some of my favorite words. I know. Get off my back. I'll take care of it. When my wife would try to talk to me, I just wouldn't hear it. I was too big a big shot, and the big shot lost his wife, or I gave up the right to that wife, and gave up the right to my two children. I've recovered since recovered that, but that's later. That's in the bud part of the story, not the buddy part. The buddy part is I'm still in that. And I couldn't fathom why this was happening to me, being the prince of a fellow that I was, a responsible fellow that I was, or in my eyes. And I started conning, I started lying to overcome, to get out of trouble, to play catch up. Now, here again, I had many opportunities, several things that I was able to put together, because it wasn't through lack of ability, it was through lack of honesty and concentration and focus. I put together two things, but several things, but somehow or another, I'd get in the middle of it, and I would neglect. I would not fulfill the responsibilities inherent in achievement. Because it takes, you know, some of that stuff, you have to do these things. And you do them by yourself. Because only you can do them at a certain point. You can gather help later. I don't know whether that makes any sense or not, but that was part of the way I was. And just kept on drinking. And then I started drinking, staying late at my office, finding some excuse to go back to the office and go in there, and I'd make a phone call this and that and the other, to let my wife know where I was, and then I'd go out, go to some of the bars, and try to be a big shot. I don't know what the hell I was doing there, but I was doing whatever this alcoholic was doing just to get away and escape being me. Because I knew me wasn't good enough. Paul Olander said it one day several years ago. I was all alone, or I felt that way, and I was not enough. And that was my attitude toward myself. When all I had to do, I had every opportunity, every door was open, every door that I needed to fulfill the responsibilities of achievement was there. And I'd screw it up. I started drinking pretty much every day, and I started sneaking drinking. I started drinking in the afternoons. Me and some of the guys, when this was going on, Commerce was done in downtown Atlanta. John knows about it. It was done between Rich's on one end and Davison's on the other. All your banks were there. Your major realty companies were there. And your insurance companies and the law firms were all there. It was all focused between those two points, or two compass points. And we started drinking in the afternoon, top of Peachtree, and we'd go for, you know, let's go eat lunch. Okay. And, you know, 4:30, I'd make an appearance at the office and then go back out to have another drink after, you know, after work with the guys under the ruse that I'd been working all this time. I was in the real estate business back then. And with some really top-notch firms, and top-notch opportunity and top-notch contacts. They were there, were ready, willing, and able to help me, and to help me fulfill some of the opportunities that were there. I was a good conceptualist, real estate-wise. So it wasn't lack of talent, it was lack of character. All I wanted to do was drink, and it got to the point where all I wanted to do was drink. Go play golf. Of course, we're going to drink at the golf course. But I'd catch myself at 10 o'clock in the morning. Instead of making calls or keeping appointments or whatever, I'd get a case of beer and hit the golf course. And that sort of stuff went on and on and on. Started getting DUIs. I got a grand total of four. And I had the physical contacts, the financial contacts, the legal contacts, where I didn't get charged on the three of them. So I figured I could beat any rap that came my way. It was not true. But I think all four of those ended up costing me only about $2,500. Of course, Atlanta was different back then. The cops had a little bit better sense of humor than they do now. For example, one of a buddy of mine and I, he had a Buick convertible, brand new Buick convertible. It's kind of a good looking car. It's a deep red, burgundy red, and good looking. And we were at a place on Peachtree called The Tree, on Peachtree, just below Piedmont Hospital. And we decided the thing we needed to do was to get his wife. Now, my wife was at home, which was right around the corner from where I lived, just off Collier Road. And we were going to go get his wife, Jean, to, you don't know the man, so I'm not destroying their anonymity. And we were going to go up and have her fix us breakfast. This was about 1:30 or 2 o'clock in the morning, I guess. And so we went and got in her car, or got in his car, and we were whipping and running up Peachtree Road. And blue light, you know, blue light special come whipping up running behind us. And he asked us, you guys been drinking? Well, no. What makes you think we've been drinking? Well, it was raining like hell and the top was down. I mean, it was not just raining, it was pouring that rain. And we were just whipping and running up Peachtree Road. Now, the cop let us go, believe it or not. But back then, you know, if stuff like that happened, it doesn't happen today. But it was interesting. I'm not going to get into war stories, but several things like that happened. One other war story, I guess. It was St. Patrick's Day, or the week before St. Patrick's. No, Halloween. And there was a guy who was a legitimate consensus All-American football player from Ole Miss. And he was about that wide and about that tall and had a voice like a foghorn. And I was in the back seat. We were going from one place to another place. This was, and they had just started daylight savings time back then. So it was still pretty light. And we were riding down out across from Spring Hill at Patterson Spring Hill when it was two-way, a two-way road. I know John remembers that. And the cop stopped us. And I was scrambling in the back. I had on coat and tie, and we all have coats and ties. And I scrambled in the back to put the liquor under the, because I was sitting in the back seat. And the other guy, I forget who was with us. I know now, but it doesn't matter. And so Charlie got out, and this line of cop, you know, Mr. Ahean, I won't use his name, but you've been drinking. No, hell no, I hadn't been drinking. No, wait a minute, no, it was, you were weaving on the, across the center line. No, I wasn't. I wasn't weaving across the center line. What are you talking about? Well, Mr. So-and-so, you've been drinking. He looked at it for a minute and said, now we got something to talk about. He let us go. He followed us to where we were going to another party. Yeah, like I say, things were different back then. But that's real. Those are a couple of the reasons why I didn't get before DUIs, where I could have gotten 54 or been in jail the whole time. But anyway, I lost track of where I am. I think I told all war stories. I got an AA. I did not come with noble purpose. It was not something I did because it sounded like a fun thing to do. I got in AA because I had run out of places to go. I'd run out of money. I'd destroyed the last business that I had, which was a productive, very productive business. They had put a lock on it because I didn't fulfill the responsibilities of had the money, but I didn't go pay the bills. I didn't pay the mortgage, and they closed us down. And that took my car, took three cars at that time, and took my house, which was on a nice little golf course. It wasn't that great a house, but it was nice. And I had also was becoming separated at that time from my third wife. Now, keeping in mind that I had one wife, the one that was in the middle, and this is the truth. To this day, I can't tell you her last name. I can tell you for a brief period of time, like a month and a half, 2 months, it was Mayfield. But that's all. I also found out, now this was not a match made in heaven, it was, I found out that about four weeks maybe after we were married, that she wasn't 35 years old. I was husband number five. But she had enough sense to kick me out of the house. And I won't go to it, but, you know, that's the kind of stuff I pulled. And it finally, that last wife I had and my children got after me a little bit. And the man I was working for, who was our money man in real estate, he was the man that was able to fund the stuff that I was putting together, because there was merit in what I was doing. And he kept up the insurance when they padlocked the business, all three business locations. And I said, I agreed to go to a treatment center. I agreed to go to a treatment center through no noble purpose. I agreed to go because I didn't have anywhere else to go. And I said, hell, this will give me a month, 28 days, whatever it was. And that time I can gather my resources and get myself together. And, you know, I knew 3 days after I was in Ridgeview Institute, I knew that I was going to be all right when I came out from the Thorazine and I found out, you know, that I was what my name was. And I read the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, hell, I understand that. That's a lead pipe cinch. I got you covered. I can teach this stuff. You people will understand it and you'll be saved and I'll be a hero. And that was my attitude. That was pretty much my attitude. You know, I was the intellectual. Anyway, I came here to Napa. Went to several other places too, but primarily I came to Napa. And I sat there with my arms folded and my arm looking out under hooded eyes, and knew that I had been relegated to a nut house. If I was crazy, you people had to be really crazy. I mean, this place was squirrely as a tree trunk. How can you do this stuff and get away with it? But I did hear some things that I identified with, because some of them I had done. And I couldn't figure out. I said, you know, you've heard the expression reading my mail, because you people kept talking, and most of the stuff hit home. Wasn't identical, but when you started talking truth and you started talking feelings and you started talking some of the things you had done, I had done some of those things too, or variations of them. There's not anything new in AA. We've all done some of these things. There's no elitist level in AA. And thank goodness for that. Or if there is, there shouldn't be. Time does not give you an elitist. It gives you more knowledge and more experience to share with another human being. Your experience, strength, and hope. That in hopes, someone can identify with it and realize that they're not totally alone, not all alone, and they don't ever have to be anymore. You can find the companionship, not so much companionship, the camaraderie, the identity, that people just like me, just like you, have suffered, and in large part don't know what to do. That we can overcome insecurity, that we can overcome doubt and fear. It does not come on a light switch. There's no such thing as light switch sobriety. And I think you know what I'm talking about that. If I graphed my progress in AA, it would go along and it would be going up gradually with some severe bumps and dips in between. I had some medical problems since I got sober. And it turned out that over a 13-year period, I was hospitalized 17 times. and had, I think it's 11 surgeries and 7 ICU visits in that, not visits, they were not fun. And there's only one reason I was able to get through that, and the only one reason I'm able to get through some of the stuff that's going on in my life now, physical stuff, is because I have got my understanding today. And I turn to it. I don't turn to it all the time. None of us have been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence. I fit that description. But I have it. And I turn to it, and I turn to it frequently. Turn inside, and I turn to you people. And I tell you the truth. I meet once a week with my sponsor. Most of the time, we meet once a week with my sponsor, whom I've had for 16 years. And I don't know what I'd do without him, without him. But if I didn't have him, there are others that I know I could turn to. I know I could turn to them, and I'll get the truth. I might not get exactly precisely what I want to hear, but I'll get the truth, and I'll get their time. And I'll get their heartfelt input. And for that, I'm grateful. I've been here, you know, I picked up a chip the other day, last month, for 19 years. Now, you know, where did that come from? You can't get here from there. You have to go somewhere else. And it's one of those things that it inspires a little, and I use this word sincerely, it inspires a little awe in me, the power of the God of my understanding of this program and of the people. The program is the people. The program is written for us, but the people who practice it, I guess is the best way to put it, or a better way to put it. And because of that, I'm alive and I'm sane, and I'm not sane. I'm not, you know, there's some, sometimes I'm about 3 pennies short of a nickel, and it shows. It just doesn't fill all the way up, you know. The tank is sometimes half empty. And I get negative, but I get through these things, and I have you people to boost and bolster me and kick me and ride with me through it. And I think we all do to some degree. Some people are better able to handle things than others, but I'm not in a comparison basis. I know I'm grateful. I know I don't think I could. No, I don't know. I know I could not. I don't think I'd literally be alive with the medical problems and some of the stuff I pulled. I don't think I'd be here. Or if I wouldn't be here, I might be in jail somewhere. I might still be alive, but that's highly doubtful. But AA pulls you through when I turn to it. I don't get over anything. I don't get around anything. But through grace, through that power, through the power of you people, the example you people set, I'm able to go through some things that I don't think I could go through by myself. And thank God I don't have to. Thank you people for listening to me while I was talking. Is that all right?
Thank you, Bud. Our seventh tradition, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions and donations to support the group and AA its own. And the baskets are coming. And, boy, do we have any volunteers that would like to give out the chips? There we go. Hello, Larry. Thank you.
Like many AA clubs across the country, we have a chip system, no clean or excuse over time, and we start with one chip. If you're just coming back or just want to try this way of life, it's a wonderful way of life. All right. So this one here is your reserve. The silver chip, I've heard it said, it's the international sign.